This is CJSF 90.1 FM, and you're tuning into our super summer programming. I'm Hallelujah.
And I'm Stella. And together, we'll be highlighting the queer community, environmental issues, and upcoming local events.
Stay tuned for interviews, discussion, and music from our collections.
Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, the lands that they have cared for since time immemorial. Today, I am with Erica, the co-executive director of Environmental Youth Alliance, an organization that continues the stewardship of our lands within the Vancouver area. So just to start off, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about you?
Hello, thanks for having me. My name is Erica. I use she, her pronouns. On my mother's side, I'm Japanese, and my father's side, I'm mixed European. So here as a guest on these lands and calling in specifically today from the unceded stolen land of the Squamish Nation. As Stella mentioned, I am the co-executive director of Environmental Youth Alliance. I've been with the organization for 6.5 years. And yeah, deeply love the work that I do, and also spend a lot of time on the land in my free time as well, with my dog, with my friends, on my bike, etc. But yeah, I think we'll get into more of the work stuff soon, so I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, lovely. We definitely will. So just first question right off the bat for some context, what does the Environmental Youth Alliance do in and for the Vancouver
community? Yeah, so Environmental Youth Alliance, we are a small nonprofit that's based out of East Vancouver. We were founded in 1989 by a group of high school students in the Vancouver region. And since then, we have, always had forms of youth leadership and connection to environmental work. So as of late, EYA has been focusing our time on working specifically with youth on Vancouver's east side, doing land-based education and environmental job skill training for youth facing barriers specifically. So we're working with BIPOC youth, Two-Spirit, LGBTQIA plus youth, youth living with disability, or other barriers, systemic barriers on Vancouver's east side. So we do lots of education programs and stewardship, and do a lot of stewardship specifically in the Strathcona neighborhood, as well as other East Van green spaces, kind of showcasing to youth that we can improve and make impact on the spaces like right in our backyard, and nature is right here for us.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned stewardship, because I wanted to ask, because I think a lot of people don't know what stewardship might comprise or consist of. So what is environmental stewardship, or at least how would you describe it in EYA?
Good question. And yeah, I think it is kind of like it can have a lot of nuance in it. So maybe like the closest connection for listeners would be to like restoration, like ecological restoration is maybe one of the umbrellas that stewardship falls under. It's maybe more of like a technical definition sometimes, but essentially stewardship as we define it has restoration practices in it. So that might be like the removing of invasive species, so like the physically like pulling of blackberry, ivy, other kind of common invasive species in our areas, and then replanting with native species and supporting the native plants to grow, and supporting biodiversity and the climate crisis in that way. I think to me, stewardship kind of expands beyond just like that, like the technical doing, and holds a bit more of like a holistic meaning to it, of like learning about and learning from the land and connecting to the land and caring for it in a bit more of like a deep way. So really encouraging youth to like learn about the plant relatives and connect with them, and support them in many different ways, whether it's, you know, sharing that with a friend and sharing, you know, how to care for the land in those ways, or doing an arts-based project, or collecting medicines that are then like turned into plant medicines that we share with the downtown east side or other folks in the community. So I think it's a bit of like a blurry definition, but I think ultimately it's like how we can care for the land and tend to the land in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's so necessary to have these kinds of interactions with the land that are not just based on going to it for a specific purpose and then leaving and having it as like a separate space outside of our city. So I think that's really great. Can you explain a bit more why it is so critical to have these kinds of land stewardship programs for youth, and specifically for youth from equity denied communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the benefits or the importance is so reciprocal, in that, you know, what I just spoke to with the stewardship, like there are clear benefits for the land with the actions that we're doing and caring for the land. But I also, yeah, recognize that there are ample benefits for the youth as well, and for communities as well. I think kind of like what I mentioned before about ensuring that like nature doesn't feel out there, like nature does have so much importance and value. You know, there's so many like health benefits and emotional regulation and all of these different pieces that, you know, there's a lot of studies that show that nature is valuable, but sometimes the barriers to access just feel so great, and nature can sometimes be advertised to us as this like big out there thing, and you know, you need to have your whole camping gear, and you need to have access to a car, and you need to, you know, look a certain way, do it a certain way, all of these things. So there can just be so many barriers to entry. So yeah, the fact that, you know, all of our youth can like walk to our sites, or we provide bus tickets so that they can easily transit to the sites, and their neighborhoods that maybe they've, you know, walked past or, you know, are connected to, just feels so important and like valuable of like, it's, yeah, the Strathcona Gardens, if you haven't been there already, it's like such an oasis in the middle of like what can feel like really like a hectic, overstimulating neighborhood right on Produce Row there. So I think just having that feels so valuable. And then beyond that, you know, the youth are not only connecting to the land and reaping, you know, kind of like benefits and like mutual growth that way, but a lot of our programs are equally as weighted on the relationships with each other and connecting with other youth, connecting with mentors in our staff team who is also youth-led, and, you know, building community and building relationships, which is really vital in the current state of the world.
Yes, most definitely. I like that you mentioned how it can seem quite exclusive to access nature, especially if we're talking about these like backcountry places that are distant and gear costs a lot of money. But we do often neglect the community spaces that we already have, and it's great that you guys are doing work in that. I was wondering, how did the organization create this kind of safe community space for learning, advocacy, and care to take place?
Such a good question, and it's like it's a lifelong, right? Like UI has been around for over 35 years now, and we spend a lot of our energy on both like our internal operations and increasing like how anti-oppressive those practices can be, and then also really focusing on having like trauma-informed programs as well. So continued journey for sure, and I'm not sitting here to saying that like our programs are a safe space, because I think that can be I don't know if anybody could ever say that. I think, you know, we strive to make them more accessible, more safe, and that's the best that we can do, and being like transparent and open with the youth is really important. But in terms of, yeah, some of those like actions that we have done to create that, kind of like the decreasing barriers, like I mentioned, we'll give every youth bus tickets to get to and from the program. We also provide like snacks as soon as the youth come in, so that, you know, if they haven't had access to breakfast, they'll be able to like get some energy right away. And we also provide lunch on all of our programs. And then each youth, we value their time and what they bring to the program so much. So all of our programs, youth either get an honoraria if it's a volunteer program, or they'll get a paid wage if it's one of our employment training programs. So those are kind of like the, like I guess, like logistical barriers we try to decrease. And then a lot comes maybe more in like the nuanced ways in which our we hire a staff team that is youthful, that is BIPOC or facing other barriers, and is representative, and like the youth can see themselves in the leadership. I think that goes a long way. And also having like peer mentors on our programs as well. So there's more touch points of trusted folks that the youth can lean on. We also, aside from like workshop series that we do, all of our programs are cohort based. So the youth are with the same group of youth throughout a season, like the whole summer season or the whole fall season. And that really supports kind of like trust building, relationship building. And we cultivate that further in the programs through, you know, icebreaker games, making sure that youth are feeling comfy before we might dive into like a big topic or, you know, more trust-based activities. So yeah, that kind of like continuity can go a long way with the youth as well.
Mm-hmm. Your organization seems to be structured a little bit different than other organizations that may not be so involved with youth. And I was wondering how that structure, or like what that structure looks like when it's youth-led for youth, and yeah, what kind of opportunities there are for youth to get involved.
Yeah, so the programs that we run that I've been speaking about, so we have a field trip program that's for school age youth, so kindergartner through to grade 12, and they'll come with their classrooms and visit. Then we have kind of one of our like flagship programs is our nature stewards programs, which is for high school age youth, where they come like on the weekends or in summer holidays for that like one time a week type of program. And then for youth that are in that older age range, like 18 to 25, that's when we have more of our like youth employment programs, where there's maybe like internship style programs or different volunteer programs, etc. So throughout kind of like those youth stages, there's like multiple ways that youth can kind of move through this leadership continuum. From there, in terms of our staff team, we try to have like shared leadership where possible. So we've moved to like a co-executive director model a few years ago, with the hopes of like continuing to support more youth in leadership positions and having like more support for our team. And then we have a super awesome team of five managers, and then coordinators and other support staff who are kind of the ones that are mostly working kind of like frontline with the youth. So just trying to have like these multiple levels of support and like policies and practices to support the staff is how we've kind of framed it to ensure that folks, yeah, are feeling supported. And then we're a nonprofit, so we have a board of directors as well. And we strive for at least half of our board of directors to identify as youth as well. And then we also have a youth advisory circle who I absolutely love working with them. It's like a group of 10 youth, and they'll meet with me each quarter and provide guidance and do some brainstorms and support EYA and continuing to have a youth voice like at kind of the front of the work that what we do. So yeah, I'm always so grateful for all of the ideas and feedback that they're able to provide as well. So yeah, there's kind of multiple ways that we have youth involved in like all parts of our organization up to the leadership roles. But it takes time and it takes intentionality to create all of these structures and roles in ways that are sustainable and supportive and interesting to youth. Because I know sometimes, you know, people will put like, oh, like a youth can sit on a board, but if it's not set up in a way that's like welcoming and, you know, structured in a way that that voice can be heard, it can sometimes create more harm than benefit.
How do you incorporate decolonial practices into EYA, if y'all do? I did read on your website that it seemed like that was an aim, and yeah, just curious about how that looks.
Yeah, I think it's something, once again, kind of similar to like the anti-oppressive practices. It's like a lifelong journey and, you know, continuing to try new things. I think there's parts of our work that are maybe more like inherently decolonial. Like I think the act of pulling out of an invasive species, you know, invasive species are almost always brought to different lands from colonial practices and systems. So I think that's such like a beautiful, really tangible thing to do, like to literally pull that thing out of the ground and like plant a native species and like learn about it, connect with it and support it. So I think that there's a lot that is inherently a decolonial practice. So then I think as an organization, kind of like building the scaffolding around that and, you know, ensuring that we're naming that and we're teaching the youth about these things and like why we're doing that, it feels like a really important piece of what we do. You know, I touched on the trauma-informed practices and like other anti-oppressive practices. So there are those pieces both like internally and on our programs that we're continuing to like workshop and continuing to try to show up for our youth in good ways. We gather plant medicines and we try to do so in ways in which we are honoring Indigenous ways of knowing and, you know, upholding Indigenous ways of knowing alongside, you know, maybe more like Western science practices and like braiding these together in all of our curricula. So when we're harvesting, we may be like leaning on some teachings that elders have shared with us around honorable harvest and trying to harvest in a good way. And then we are processing these medicines and sharing it back with the Indigenous communities surrounding us or organizations on the downtown east side and trying to continue to share out the gifts that we might have to offer to the communities around us. You know, there's other, I think just in like what voices we bring into programs, we're always ensuring that we include visits from Indigenous knowledge keepers or elders in our communities to come into each of our programs and share their teachings with our youth. And we are so grateful and lucky for some of those relationships that we hold in the community. And then not to bore with like operations and stuff, but there's little things as well of like providing like flexible stats to our youth or to our staff, because you know, our staff come from so many different cultures and our colonial statutory holidays don't align with what other folks are celebrating. So ensuring we're providing like flexibility on that and giving Indigenous Peoples Day as a paid day off and other forms of like flexibility with personal time off and things like that, and just trying to have a more decolonized approach to, you know, employees and how we show up in work and how that is, as much as we try not to, it is so interwoven with who we are as a whole person and individually as well.
Yeah, definitely. Would you say there are any difficulties in committing to decoloniality when a lot of like maybe the broader environmental movement or the government may not share similar values or operate on more colonial frameworks?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yeah, I mean, I think short answer would be yes. I think, you know, there are the systems that be, and, you know, I think there's certain things in being a nonprofit and, you know, society's active board of directors, and there's like different like forms of power that come into these spaces that we have an incredible board of directors. But, you know, there's continually kind of like poking at what is upheld in these systems and like what do we need to continue to uphold, like what do we need to, you know, like checks and balances of all of that, and what do we actually have some like flexibility to like do it in a way that feels really values aligned. So like all of this, I guess in a nutshell, just like takes a lot of time, and you need to have folks on board to like have these conversations and explore options that might not be the status quo or like the easiest way. So sometimes, you know, as a nonprofit too, like, and we're a small team and resources are slim, and having time to do that can definitely be a barrier sometimes. And then, yeah, you know, funding comes from federal sources sometimes, and there's employment standards that are set in certain ways. So it's always, yeah, we are not separate from these systems, but it is, yeah, how do we, you know, show up in these relationships and ensure we are, you know, following what we need to, and how do we, where do we have flexibility to continue to explore and have some conversations?
Yeah, definitely. Even at CJSF, there's always this balance, because we're also like independent nonprofit of like we need to maintain funding to be able to do what we want to do, but also retain our values and what we stand for. And I think a lot of nonprofits or independent organizations deal with that struggle.
Totally. Yeah, totally.
And are there any needs, do you think, that EYA addresses that the dominant environmentalist movement doesn't consider? Or even just, you know, like, people who think about environmentalism and they think of a specific type of environmentalism? And I was just wondering if there's any needs or, I guess, gaps that EYA can address?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you speak of like environmentalism, the form of environmentalism that EYA is, or I guess like kind of like our guiding principle would be the intersectional environmentalism. So kind of looking at both like social injustices and environmental crises, and like recognizing that the youth that EYA is working with are disproportionately impacted by these climate crises and also excluded from being a part of, you know, the discussion or environmental advocacy and careers. So there are systems that are kind of like from both angles oppressing the youth that EYA might be working with. So yeah, absolutely gaps in the sector. So I think especially when looking at our employability programs that are, you know, designed to support youth and kind of like launching into an environmental career. You know, these programs try to look at needs in many different ways. So yes, we're doing like the technical learning of, you know, restoration practices or native plant horticulture. But how do we also support youth in like unpacking what professionalism means and like what they might need to uphold in decolonial ways, or you know, communication styles and some of these like soft skills, and even the act of just like working on a team on the land together and what you might be able to take away from that. So trying to empower them and, you know, give them skills so that they can navigate careers in the environmental sector, and specifically, you know, a sector that isn't always built for everyone. So yeah, that's kind of our goal with a lot of those programs.
Nice. And I know you mentioned earlier that the work that you do is really meaningful to you. And I've noticed a pattern of a lot of people who work in nonprofits or independent organizations being really passionate about the work that they do. And I was wondering if you could just, if you wanted to share about like why it's meaningful or like what you draw from your work.
Yeah. Yeah, so I am a person of color, and I feel really lucky to have had an upbringing where I was really connected to nature, and I think that inspired my career path, and I know that that's a privilege that not everybody gets. And yeah, so anyways, fast forward through the career to getting into outdoor education. I was working at a few different places doing outdoor education. And after some time, I, you know, was just kind of looking at who was accessing these programs, and continually was starting to feel a little bit frustrated of seeing more affluent folks being kids and youth being able to access these programs. And I think knowing the impact that like nature access and connection had for me, you know, I was just like really, that gap was feeling really vital of like, I was feeling like people who needed these programs the most were not, like I wasn't seeing on these programs at all. So I was sitting in this, you know, frustration as I was like going through different workplaces. And yeah, then the EYA, a job opening came up. This was 6.5 years ago. And yeah, I think the fact that there's something there that's specifically tackling these, you know, kind of like two challenges or like focus areas of my life were kind of woven in together in this way that actually felt really like tangible and meaningful. Just like felt like I landed in the right place. And you know, now being at the organization for a few years and continually seeing the impact that, you know, being on the land side by side with people. And like, I feel so lucky when I get to go out and visit a program and be with youth on the land and just like get so much like joy and I think hope in a time that, you know, hope is really needed and can feel really far away sometimes. I think, you know, the small actions that we can do together in community on the land feel really grounding for me. So I feel really lucky to be able to do this work.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I do agree that it is really hard to keep seeing people from equity denied communities being even further denied just resources and funding and research, even when they're the ones who are the most impacted by things like the climate crisis. And so you guys are doing really important work at EYA. That's part of the reason I wanted to interview you and like put a little spotlight on your organization. So other organizations can maybe be inspired, or other people as well. And just a question, do you think there's anything environmentalist organizations and other movements could learn from EYA, or I guess the incorporation of Indigenous knowledge as well within EYA?
Good question. I appreciate the flowers as well, but I think like we're all in community together and we are continually inspired and in awe of some of the other incredible orgs and folks in our community as well. I think just, be intentional about engaging youth or incorporating a youth voice, but don't be afraid of it as well. I think sometimes, you know, when it's like incorporating Indigenous knowledge or incorporating youth voice, like you do want to do it well, and yes, do it well, but also don't lead with fear in that as well. And, you know, be open and transparent and intentional about it. And I think it can take you, really far. So yeah, no big words of wisdom, but maybe something along those lines. And happy to connect with other folks and organizations as well. We get a lot of joy out of collaborating with folks working in this space too.
Yeah, definitely. And just to begin wrapping up at least, I know EYA offers a lot of great programs. You've already kind of mentioned them, but it would be great if you could go over some of these in more detail for our listeners.
Yeah, for sure. So, if you are curious, our website is www.eya.ca, super straightforward, so you can find us there. So like I mentioned, we have our school field trip program. So if you're a teacher, specifically a teacher in East Vancouver or other under-resourced neighborhoods, definitely reach out for our Wild Minds field trip program and come and bring your classroom to a field trip at Strathcona. If you are a high school age student and interested in volunteering, our fall programs will open up fairly soon, and you can come out for like every Saturday in the fall or a different season in the future, and you can come learn about plants, engage in land stewardship, and help grow plants in our plant nursery. And you do get paid an honoraria, get bus tickets and lunches for that. If you are a youth that's 18 to 25, we have a few different youth employment programs. We have our peer mentor program, which is a volunteer program for youth that might be interested in exploring careers in environmental education. So in this program, you build skills and also shadow and support our younger youth programs as a peer mentor. So you're kind of there as a support and a building facilitation. Land-based facilitation skills there. We also have our Roots and Shoots program, which is a work experience style youth employment program where you'll come and do land-based training with our team for 8 weeks. So we'll have a fall cohort of that. And you will learn all kinds of environmental job skills as well as employability skills like building your resume, communication, etc. And that's a paid program. And we also have Cultivate, which is our workshop series program, a bit more lower barrier accessible for folks that want to build employability skills but might not be able to commit to a full-time program. And then finally, we have our Youth Habitat Crew program, which is our summer job opportunity program. And this is where a cohort of 8 youth come together and steward EYA sites throughout the summer. So lots of programs going on at different times of year, and we'd love to hear from you and see you on our programs.
Great. And how can our listeners who may not be able to volunteer or work at EYA, is there any ways that they can support?